Welcome to Community Forum, a weekly call-in program produced at the studios of KSKA. Opinions expressed are those of the guest, host, and callers, and do not represent the views of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. And now, the host of Community Forum, Nellie Moore.
Good afternoon. It's a fantastic Wednesday afternoon in South Central Alaska. It's sunny out there, and we're in here, Chris. I don't know how we did that, but anyway, welcome to Community Forum. It is a live call-in program if you're listening in the afternoon. If you're listening in the evening, it's been pre-recorded and you cannot call in. We're going to get into the show in just a second here, but first of all, I want to say I found out, in the interest of disclosure, KSKA receives funding from the Renewable Energy Alaska Project as a nonprofit client. And that's where my guest is from today. Chris Rose, how are you?
I'm well, thank you, Nellie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit. Is it okay to call it REAP?
Sure.
Okay, let's talk about REAP for just a little bit and explain what it is.
Sure. REAP is a statewide coalition of organizations ranging from small and large utilities to environmental groups, consumer groups, Alaska Native organizations, businesses, and state and federal agencies that all share the goal of increasing the production of renewable energy here in the state.
And I took a look at the list of those, and some are very familiar. Kotzebue Electric, they've got some wind stuff going on. Golden Valley up in Fairbanks, Municipal Light and Power, Green Star, Chena Hot Springs Resort, all kinds of people are in there. And so we're very excited to see this kind of collaboration in a state where often people don't like to collaborate.
Yeah, it is exciting, and I think out of the new members we're getting a lot of businesses lately, and that's exciting to us, especially since some of them are out-of-state renewable energy developers who see the work we're doing is actually starting to create a market for renewable energy development. Mm-hmm. So it's exciting to see all the different folks who are working together.
I guess the big thing is you've got a fair coming up this weekend that people can attend.
That's right. This Saturday, the 9th of August, from 11 till 9 p.m., is the fourth annual Alaska Renewable Energy Fair. And this is an opportunity for folks to come out and learn a little bit more about how renewable energy works. We'll have all kinds of displays, solar panels up, wind turbines. The purveyors of those kinds of equipment will be at the fair. We'll have 15 different workshops with topics ranging from Fire Island wind to geothermal development, all kinds of different things that people can come learn about throughout the afternoon. We have live music, all kinds of children's activities, food, craft vendors, and so on. So it's a fun family event.
I'm sure it will be, and hopefully the weather will hold up for us. I wanted to talk a little bit about where Alaska's at. If you were to give us a report card right now on the use of renewable energy resources, what kinds of things would you write on it?
I'm not sure what grade I would give us yet. Certainly for effort, we're increasing that quite a bit in leaps and bounds. As you probably know, the legislature passed a bill last spring to create a renewable energy grant fund, and they committed $50 million a year for the next 5 years for grants for utility-scale renewable energy development. That's fantastic. Alaska went from kind of being out in left field to being the state only second to California in the whole country in terms of the commitment of investment.
Wow, that's great.
That they're putting toward renewable energy. But what we need to do is implement that. Mm-hmm. So I know the Energy Authority, which is administering the fund, is staffing up so that they'll have more people to take in these grant proposals and check the viability of the projects that are asking for money. And we're really hoping that the $50 million a year that the state's providing is just going to leverage a lot more private investment. So that $50 million a year is going to represent hundreds of millions of dollars in investment over the course of over the 5 years. And I think that the legislature understands why it's important, especially today when we've got so much dependence on fossil fuels,
right?
Not just in Alaska, but everywhere. But here, especially in the villages, diesel dependence, oil for heating, and the price of oil is just going to keep going up. It's dropping a little bit right now, but it's not going to go too much further down before it just gets creeping up again. So.
Right.
Renewables is flat price power, and that's the real beauty of it is that once you install this stuff, you don't have fuel costs to worry about over the course of the project.
Mm-hmm. What kind of interest have you had from for-profit organizations? Have you had companies approaching you saying, hey, let's try out, we've got this equipment, let's try it out? I know some of that happened in Kotzebue many years ago,
mm-hmm.
you know, just by saying, hey, this is a pretty windy city, let's see how our equipment performs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely, that's happening. Some of the developers I mentioned from out of state and also from in-state are looking at all kinds of different technologies that they can implement here in Alaska, whether it be tidal power or wind power. And they're certainly consulting us and asking us some questions, but we're not the experts on trying to get them to get it, this stuff in the ground. We can kind of point them in the right direction. And that's where the collaboration of REAP as a coalition comes in, because it's a great networking body for people to get to know each other.
Mm-hmm. When you say tidal power, what does that mean? I mean, it seems like people here in South Central talk about it a lot because we have huge tides, but what mm-hmm. does that actually mean?
Well, tidal power is often called in-stream kinetic power. But basically, what you're doing is you're putting in something that may appear like a wind turbine underwater and taking advantage of the tidal flows back and forth. So it's, if you could imagine a wind turbine underwater that is bidirectional, so it will mm-hmm. it will spin no matter which way the tide is flowing. So if it's ebb tide or not, it's still going to be spinning. And that technology is just commercializing. In fact, there was just an installation done in Great Britain that's really going to be the first commercial application of tidal power in the world. There have been demonstration projects, but this is a technology that's just coming online and will continue to improve and be used more and more all around the world. But Alaska has half of the whole United States' tidal power potential. So there's an amazing amount of potential up here. We also have a lot of wave power potential, which is a different way to use ocean power to generate electricity.
Mm-hmm. And is that like rough seas or?
Any kind of waves will work. And basically what you're doing is taking advantage of the up and down motion mm-hmm. of the waves. And there's several different devices that have been invented and are being demonstrated around the world to take advantage of that. There's a commercial application that's just going in off the coast of Portugal right now that the Portuguese government is doing. Mm. So these projects are coming. We want to be ready for them. I would say the tidal and the wave power is a little bit further off than some of the technologies like wind, which are certainly mature.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what is the latest in wind technology? It seems like we've had a few iterations of it, but we should be pretty well advanced by now, I would think.
It is advancing. When I went down to the American Wind Energy Association annual meeting and trade show in Houston in June, I was amazed. First of all, last year there was about 7,000 people down in Los Angeles for this event, and we all thought, well, gosh, 7,000 people at a wind conference, that's a big deal. Well, this mm-hmm. year there was 13,000 people.
Wow.
It almost doubled in 1 year. And the thing that really stood out was it was announced at that time that last year of all the new electric generation capacity put in the entire United States, 35% of it was wind. So wind is definitely come of age. It is growing very, very quickly, about 30% a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the advancements are really coming in technology, you know, making the equipment more sophisticated, but also in scale.
Mm-hmm.
So the bigger these things get, the more economies of scale you can get out of it. So, you know, when we had these 50-kilowatt wind turbines like we've got in Kotzebue, that was state-of-the-art mm-hmm. 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now those are puny compared to the big ones that are going in, and the Germans are making 5 and 6 megawatt turbines, which are, you know, hundreds of times bigger.
Mm-hmm. Are they an environmental issue as far as the placement? I mean, are they noisy? What considerations do communities have to take into account if they're looking at, you know, putting in something like that?
Sure. Well, like with any power generation, whether it be coal or natural gas or anything, there are issues that have to be dealt with up front. And the primary issues that are dealt with wind turbines have to do with both siting and avian impacts. And so over the last 25 years, the wind industry has put a ton of money into studying birds and studying how to place those turbines so that they don't have great impacts on avian life or bats. And Also, of course, the viewshed, and we don't have that problem as much here in Alaska because we're so kind of a small population with not that many people. But on the East Coast, there are battles being waged right now about whether or not people want to look at a wind turbine.
I think Ted Kennedy got embroiled in that when...
Cape Wind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of wind out there, hot air, Cape Wind. We are talking about renewable energy. My guest today, Chris Rose, and we want you to join in if you have questions or comments, suggestions, recollections. Our phone number, 550-8433, 550-8433 is our local number outside Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752. That's 1-888-353-5752. And email is at communityforum@kska.org. And I do have a question in for you, Chris. And let's see a little bit of background here. Palmer, the community, is going to be holding a zoning meeting August 21 to talk about zoning for wind generators. And there's talk of completely disallowing the use of wind energy in residential zoning and other zones. As an attorney and one who is very informed regarding conservation and natural resources, my question is, wind a natural resource? And if so, are those rights regarding access to it protected by the Alaska State Constitution?
Well, I'm not going to give you a legal opinion, Ellie.
Darn.
Wind is certainly considered a natural resource by some jurisdictions. I don't think the state of Alaska has gotten to the point where they have included that in the definition of natural resources. But certainly all our renewable energy resources are natural resources. I don't know if anyone's ever made an argument up to our state Supreme Court to just make that clear. In terms of whether or not your access to them is protected, I don't know. But then there'd be a multiple list, you know, a list of other questions after that. Well, even if it is protected, does that mean you can develop it anywhere? And certainly, we don't allow development of any of other resources just anywhere. Mm-hmm. There are restrictions that are put on the development of all natural resources.
And who is it that regulates those restrictions?
Well, DNR in this state, Department of Natural Resources, regulates most of that. And in fact, DNR is involved in regulating geothermal development, which is occurring right now. Mount Spur, which is a large geothermal possibility, the volcano 80 miles west of Anchorage, is up for lease right now. And that's exciting because...
What?
Yeah, the geothermal rights are up for lease, and this is something that the DNR has been working on for about 18 months.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So what does it give the lease or – wait a minute.
Well,
the rights to
– Yeah, the lessor is the state of Alaska. Mm-hmm. These tracts are actually state land, and they have put out for competitive bid rights to develop those tracts. And my understanding is September 10th, they'll actually be opening up sealed bids. And so we'll see who has bid on working to develop that geothermal resource over there, which we need to explore. And one of the things that developer will probably be doing is drilling some exploratory holes just to see what we've got. Because from the preliminary investigations over there, you know, the geochemistry and so on, there's a large likelihood there's some kind of geothermal resource. The question is, you know, how hot's the water? How much water is there? And if there's a lot of hot water, it could be a pretty big development. 5,200 megawatts is what some folks are estimating.
Kind of sounds like a Johnny Cash song, "How Hot's the Water, Mama," or something like that. Okay, you are listening to Community Forum on KSKA. It is a live call-in program if you're listening in the afternoon. We're going to go to the phones now. Our number, 550-8433. We're talking about renewable energy with Chris Rose and a big renewable energy fair coming up this weekend here in Anchorage. But right now, we're going to Bill on line 5. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Hello. Yeah, just a quick question, Chris. Everything seems to be geared towards companies investing in the state, and for small investors or individuals or small groups of individuals who want to do something with wind power, is there any advancement on the state regulation level to do with net metering that would kind of level the playing field for so that the average citizen could get involved in this without being part of a big company?
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's a good question. Maybe I could explain net metering for those who don't understand what that means. Net metering is a law that states have passed, and you know, I think 30 or 40 states have passed net metering laws. And they're all a little bit different, but essentially what they do is they require – they set up standard rules that require utilities to buy back power from independent producers. So if you have a wind turbine or a solar panel at your house, you can sell your excess power into the grid, and whatever – you know, the difference between how much you buy from them and how much you sell to them is the net. And so essentially you get to sell them the net. We don't have a net metering law in the state of Alaska. However, the 2005 Federal Energy Policy Act required all the states to at least look at this issue. So our Regulatory Commission of Alaska has a docket open right now on this issue of net metering. And there have been multiple opportunities in recent months for people to make public comment about that. And I can't give you the exact place where that docket is right now, but if Bill would like to check out the Regulatory Commission of Alaska website, you would definitely find some more information about what the RCA is doing about net metering here in Alaska.
Interesting. Did that satisfy your question, Bill?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to – oh, I'm sorry.
There's hope.
Okay, we're going to move on now to Sheila on line six. Welcome to the show, Sheila. Hello, Sheila.
This is Sheila. Do you know anything about the wind-generated proposed farm at Delta Junction? I lived there in the 70s when NASA had their test turbine up, and I was wondering, were they going to use that good data they got then? Because they definitely were generating wind back in 70.
That's an excellent question. As far as I know, there are at least two private entities who are interested in developing wind near Delta, and they have their own anemometers up measuring wind again just to make sure that they know what the wind speed and direction and all that is. And I think that that's a good prospect. There are at least, like I said, a couple companies and numerous sites outside of Delta that folks are looking at toward development.
Thank you. I was also there when they had the atomic pile at Greeley, and when they closed that down. Are they talking about the atomic pile up in the interior again? There was one proposed for Galena last time I heard.
Are you talking about some small nuclear reactor or something like that?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know that. The only nuclear proposal I am aware of is the one that was shopped around for Galena and other places that Toshiba was offering. So I'm not aware of that proposal.
Okay.
Thanks for your call. I wanted to ask you, it seems like years ago, farmers, ranchers have had utilized wind power for many, many years.
Absolutely.
What happened?
Well, they still are. And if you look around the West now, there's all kinds of wind turbines. Of course, they were using what were called windmills then to pump up water. That was the primary use of those windmills. And the modern wind turbines are a different machine. They're really a different animal, and they are used more to produce electricity. But they're being used. It's very popular around the American West, and I've seen some of the smaller turbines up here in Alaska. Of course, there's nothing stopping people from putting up wind turbines unless there's a zoning regulation. The real question that I think Bill was getting at is whether or not you get to sell it back.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
In Fairbanks, the Golden Valley Electric Association has set up a program that allows people who have their own renewable energy systems to sell the power back to Golden Valley at what they call the avoided cost, which is essentially what Golden Valley would have paid for the fuel they would have needed to generate that same amount of power.
Hmm.
And then on top of that, everybody in the Golden Valley Service District who wants to support renewable energy is donating money that Golden Valley holds in an escrow account and then distributes at the end of the year, every Earth Day, in fact, in proportion to all the folks who have been producing renewable energy in proportion to how much they produced. And so,
wow.
The last few years, they've all been getting about $1.57.5 per kilowatt hour, which is, you know, 10 times what the retail rate is. And I know Homer Electric is very interested in putting together the same kind of program. It's called the SNAP program. Mm-hmm. And I know MEA has also been talking about it lately. So there are ways that you can incentivize local development like that without necessarily having the net metering law, although for a lot of people that would be the preferred route.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about what's available to individuals. I know I've seen solar panels. What's out there?
Well, first let me say that REAP really is focusing mostly on utility scale stuff.
Okay.
So we don't do a lot of work with individuals, but there are numerous companies, and most of them will be set up at the Renewable Energy Fair on Saturday around Alaska that do sell wind turbines, solar panels. Another thing that folks have been starting to look at more closely in Alaska is ground source heat pumps or geothermal heat pumps, which is a way to basically extract the constant temperature that's in the earth and use it to either heat or cool your home.
Wow.
And there are a million of those installations around the United States. There are not that many up here in Alaska, but the Juneau Airport is now looking at putting in a geothermal heat pump.
That is very interesting.
Yeah, so that's another thing that folks have been doing. But it really kind of boils down to solar and wind for the most part in terms of what the average person is going after. There was a pretty good article in the Daily News just a couple days ago about just how many people around the state are starting to go toward producing their own power.
Mm-hmm. Do we have a feel for how many people that is?
I think the article said that it could be in the thousands. Mm-hmm. No one tracks that.
Yeah.
And so I think the reporter got most of her information from just talking to some of the businesses who sell the turbines and the solar panels.
And I know you did clarify that you're talking mostly utility scale, but what about regulations of the equipment itself, safety issues like, you know, what if the propellers fly
right.
off like they did once in Kotzebue and
yeah.
thank goodness didn't hit anybody, and this is way before the recent things that they put out.
Right. I don't think that happens very often. I think that just with any other kind of equipment, though, you know, there are warranties from manufacturers. But, you know, anytime you're generating electricity, you've got other kinds of bodies like UL or IEEE that are looking at certifying the equipment so that,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're not just having companies out there selling electric generation equipment that is, made in the backyard, so to speak. You know, this is very, very sophisticated equipment
mm-hmm.
now, especially the larger wind turbines. General Electric is, you know, for instance, one of the big companies here in the United States that makes wind turbines. So this stuff goes through the same kind of rigorous technical specifications that other kinds of equipment does.
You're listening to Community Forum on KSKA. Today we're talking with Renewable Energy Alaska Project person Chris Rose and about the fair that's coming up this weekend here in Anchorage. If you'd like to join in the discussion, if you have some ideas or suggestions, let's see, our local number 550-8433 or our toll-free is 1-888-353-5752.
One thing I wanted to mention, Nellie, is that our keynote speaker this year is named Daniel Lurch. He's from the Post Carbon Institute in California. He's actually working in Portland right now. But he's going to be a very interesting speaker, I think, for folks to come here at 5:30 on the Park Strip during the fair. But he's also going to be speaking tomorrow night. That's Thursday the 7th at East High School Auditorium at 7 p.m. So it'll give people an opportunity to come see him Thursday evening if they can't come to the Renewable Energy Fair on Saturday. But he just wrote a book called Post-Carbon Cities, Planning for Energy and Climate Uncertainty. And he's going to this is basically a manual for local government officials to figure out how do they plan for the fact that oil is a finite resource. It's getting more and more expensive. It's really causing all kinds of implications for our communities. And climate change, which is obviously something that's already impacting Alaskans a lot. And so he's going to be focusing on that during his talk. And one of the things I'd asked him to really zero in on is food.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, food takes a heck of a lot of fossil fuels to produce the way we're producing it right now.
And preserve in many cases.
And preserve. And then on top of that, we're at the end of a very, very long supply chain up here because we do not grow most of our food. up here. So the implications for Alaskans and our food regarding energy like this going into the future is really an important topic that hopefully will generate some discussion on.
Mm-hmm. I think more and more people are getting concerned about it, as you were saying, in light of the high prices for heating fuel and the fact that most of rural Alaska is on stove oil, diesel, mm-hmm. whatever. And this winter, everybody is expecting a very rough time. I mean, the other day, AFN and National right. Congress of American Indians held that forum on right. rural energy needs. And it'll be interesting to see how quickly rural Alaska can catch up. I mean, it seems like Anchorage is a little bit behind, but rural Alaska is way behind.
Well, because unfortunately, they're really, really reliant on oil, whether it be in the form of diesel or heating oil. Mm-hmm. And because of supply and demand, it's a simple economic equation. Because of world demand skyrocketing with countries like China and India demanding more oil, and the finite supply, there hasn't been a major oil discovery in the world for 30 years. A really huge field like we are, dipping into right now. I mean, Prudhoe Bay is a huge field, but it's been 30 years since that was found. Most of the big, or I should say all of the big oil finds in Saudi Arabia were found 30, 40 years ago. And so what we're looking at and what Daniel Lurch will be speaking about on Thursday night and at the fair again is this concept of peak oil, which does not mean that we're running out of oil. What it means is that we've reached the halfway point in production. And it means that the second half of that production is going to be way more expensive. And I think we're just starting to see the beginning of that right now. I mean, the prices have doubled in the last year.
It's going to be an interesting winter. Let's see here. We're going to go back to the phones now, and then we'll pick up an email. Marcia on line 10, welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to talk to you, Glenn. I'm kind of interested in knowing if you've got any information regarding alternative wind generation modes. I read, I believe it was in Popular Science, about a method that they were developing. It's not finished yet. That uses tubes that could be, let's put next to your house, that would have an internal vibrator. That would pick up, or internal vein that would pick up the wind vibrations and be able to use that rather than the big turbine. Have you mm-hmm. heard anything about that?
I haven't heard about exactly what you've just described, but I have heard about what are called vertical axis turbines. So if you go Google vertical axis wind turbines, you'll come up with essentially something similar to what you said. Instead of the kind of turbines that well, we call them horizontally mounted, horizontal axis turbines, the ones that we always think of when you picture one. These are turbines that are oriented the other way. And so I have seen those kinds of turbines being put on city buildings and so on. They're a lot less obtrusive. They don't have the same kinds of potential impacts, and they can generate some power. They're not supposedly yet as efficient as the horizontal wind turbines, but they can produce electricity. And I know that, like I said, architects and designers are starting to incorporate them into some of the buildings that they're putting together. But just look at vertical axis wind turbines.
Excellent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, we're going to move on to Bill on line 3. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about propane-powered fuel cells, MEA, had proposed some 4 or 5 years ago. We're kind of on a waiting list, but no movement on that. Any info on that?
I don't have any recent info. The fuel cell that runs down at Exit Glacier runs on propane. Essentially what you're doing is you're extracting the hydrogen out of that propane. Ultimately, what would be much better is if you could get the hydrogen through electrolysis. And even better than that is if you could use renewable energy like wind-generated electricity to power the electrolysis process. And I did see that folks at MIT just recently have discovered a new way to do electrolysis that uses a lot less energy than previously previously used. So that might be a breakthrough in getting a way that we can produce hydrogen for fuel cells. Of course, we've got this huge opportunity to do something like that in Alaska because we've got lots and lots and lots of renewable energy resources like wind that's out very far away from where anyone lives.
Right, and that would help people that are on the power grid, but people who are off on the side when they want to do their laundry or run something like the well pump need to start their generator, and that's where this propane-powered fuel cell would have been a lot more economic in the long run and actually put less pollutants into the atmosphere. So that's why I called on that one.
Sure. Well, you know, ultimately, though, with propane, you're still dealing with a fossil fuel that price is going to keep going up on. So if you can make the hydrogen, which is essentially all you want in the propane for anyway, if you can make that hydrogen with renewables, you're getting around that fuel cost. And I think ultimately that's where a lot of this fuel cell technology is going to go.
Right. Ultimately, but it'd be nice to have some steps to get to that point. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Okay, lots of interesting ideas. I noticed in California, Governor Arnold has, they've actually got some hydrogen stations, mm-hmm. a certain number of them, which is small, mm-hmm. but for a small use of hydrogen-powered vehicles at this
right.
point.
Yeah, and I think that with any of these breakthroughs, it certainly takes technology, it takes money, but it also takes political will. And Governor Schwarzenegger is showing that there's political will there in California to do something, and that's where these breakthroughs are going to happen. Is that you have to have policy in place that's really going to incentivize this development, mm-hmm. and states around the world are now competing for investment dollars from firms that want to come in and innovate.
Mm-hmm. You've been around Alaska for a while. You know, it just seems like any environmentalist or conservationist or, you know, are always given a bad name, and it sort of slides over to people who are interested in renewable resources. But I think that is changing quite a bit in mm-hmm. our current political system, even though, you know, we have a long way to go.
I think it is changing because I think people are understanding that what we're talking about with renewable energy is flat price power. This is an economic issue. How do we produce electricity? How do we generate heat? How do we do all these things and have it cost less? And if we continue to rely on fossil fuels exclusively, we're really going to be paying a lot more. We were really, really lucky here in Alaska for so long that we had really cheap natural gas, and mm-hmm. now that's over.
Mm-hmm.
We're paying a lot more than we did even 3 years ago. We doubled, more than doubled, and yet we're still below national average natural gas prices here. Most people don't realize we're still below the national average price, and
yeah.
so we've got further to go. And folks, I think, are realizing that if you can develop a renewable energy resource, that just makes economic sense.
Well, think about this. A few years ago, it's not so much true now, but a few years ago, it's cheaper to buy a 100-pound bottle of propane to power your cooking mm-hmm. stove in the villages than to hook it up to electricity. And now it's going the other way.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. And you know, another example of that is in places like Sitka, and other places in Southeast, in fact, that have really flat-priced, a lot of flat-priced hydropower. It's really cheap. And now oil prices are getting so high that folks in Sitka are changing from oil heat to electric heat.
Wow, yeah,
because,
that's huge.
Yeah, and what it's doing, though, is I think Sitka, the Sitka utility, burned more diesel fuel last year than ever because they're trying to keep up with the electric demand because people are switching over to electric heat.
Oh, right.
And so now they're looking at expanding one of their hydro resources there so that they can have more electric heat because they just know people are going to be using it. And, you know, that's actually that's a good segue into this whole issue of hydro that's coming up
mm-hmm.
because, you know, the legislature just put $2.5 million into studying Susitna again. Chacachamna Lake is a very excellent hydro prospect that is, you know, over by Mount Spur, pretty close to the power grid that a lot of folks are talking about. And so these things are getting back in the news. People are starting to weigh, you know, the pros and cons of large hydro. And a lot of questions are being asked about that I think that the public needs to really consider, you know, how are we going to get our power in the future? And,
mm-hmm.
and hydro is a great resource.
What do you think will be, or when do you think we might see a utility scale renewable energy project occur in South Central Alaska?
Well, if you count Kodiak, next year. Kodiak Electric has already bought commercial utility scale wind turbines from GE. They've bought 3 1.5 megawatt machines, and they're in the process of getting Pillar Mountain ready for those machines. And so that's going to really be the first place in Alaska, for sure, we know, that's going to have large scale wind turbines. But I think Fire Island's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, is right here off the coast of Anchorage. That is or could be a very large wind project. It'll probably start out at least the 30-40 megawatt range, which is big. It's a really big wind project, but it could be even larger depending on how the project develops. But last spring, the legislature did approve and the governor signed an appropriation for $25 million to help cover the cost of the electric line out to the island,
mm-hmm.
which are really – it's basically a direct pass-through savings to all the consumers in South Central Alaska, because that just means $25 million the developer doesn't have to pass on in the
right.
cost of power.
Right.
So I think that's going to happen. The FAA has resolved their concerns and put in writing that they don't have any concern about the project. So that's excellent. And, SERI – you asked about for-profit companies earlier. I mean, SERI...
which is a landowner, I guess, on Fire Island.
Right. They own about three-quarters of Fire Island. SERI has joined up with a company called Anexco, and they formed a partnership called Wind Energy Alaska, and they're really working hard now to put together the pricing for that project so they can offer power agreements to the utilities and get rolling.
Very interesting. And, yes, we have... Do these things cause turbulence? The huge windmills, do they create any kind of turbulence?
No, not that I know of. I mean, if you're right next to it, if you're 250 feet in the air, you're gonna feel something. But it's not gonna create turbulence for airplanes or anything. If mm-hmm. that's what you're thinking about.
Yeah.
In fact, Fire Island, those turbines, the tip of their blade is going to be, around 400 feet, and the regulated airspace there is 1,400 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if a plane would have to be 1,000 feet too low there to be anywhere close to one of those turbines.
Mm-hmm. What about ground movement? Do these huge turbines make vibration on the earth?
Well, there's a little bit of a vibration. All that's taken care of in engineering and the way they put in the very deep foundations in most of these things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to be an issue for anybody nearby. I mean, of course, there's nobody who lives out on Fire Island right now, but I've never heard of that as an issue for folks.
You are listening to Community Forum on KSKA today. We're talking about renewable energy. Give us a call if you want to join in the discussion. My guest today is Chris Rose. And our number, 550-8433, that's 550-8433, or 1-888-353-5752. I wanted to, Gary had emailed in about green buildings. We haven't really talked about that, and I know that's not exactly our topic, but it's something I think that is fast becoming...
very important.
Yes, very important. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Very important in, saving resources. Is all of this sort of piggybacking on all of the renewable energy things that are coming out about, or?
I don't know which comes first in terms of getting the word out. I think energy efficiency has been around for a long, 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 long time. And I'm glad that you mentioned it, Nellie, because that is our best investment. Renewable energy is great. You can generate clean, flat-price power. But if you're just wasting that power, it doesn't make any sense. And
mm-hmm.
so efficiency has to be the first thing that we do. And, last spring, the legislature put $300 million into efficiency, which was huge. To put that in perspective, AHFC, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, which administers most of the efficiency programs in the state, had only spent about $150 million on efficiency since the 80s.
Wow.
So all of a sudden they get $300 million more, $200 million to add to weatherization programs that had already existed, and then $100 million for energy efficiency rebate programs. So this is a big deal. However, the folks who are working on these programs believe that we're going to need more. We're going to need more money as time goes on. But it's definitely our best investment. That's the low-hanging fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the cost of a building, 50% of the cost of a building is operations and maintenance. So you have to look at it over the life cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Only about 15 or 20% of the cost of a building is construction. And,
right.
And most people think, well, that's all. You know, when I build a building, that's the cost. Well, that's not true. The cost is actually maintaining and operating that. And so that's why what you mentioned as green building or LEED certification buildings or just simple energy efficiency
mm-hmm.
makes a ton of sense. And I know that there's a lot of folks talking about how we can be more efficient here in this state. There's lots and lots of things we could be doing,
mm-hmm.
from lighting to better appliances to more insulation to better windows, all kinds of things that we should be doing that pay back very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm. And I notice even in the loan applications, the better your home is energy-wise, I think the more benefit there is to you financially.
That's right. Well, certainly with AHFC financing, you get a better rate. If
mm-hmm.
if you have a five-star house or some kind of similar rating in energy efficiency, because, of course, the
yeah.
lender knows you're going to have more spare income because you're not paying it into utility bills. You can pay your mortgage easily or more easily. So it does make a lot of sense. There's a thing called performance contracting, too, which is really fascinating to me when I first learned about it. Essentially, it works this way. A company comes to, let's say a large commercial building owner and says, I'll do a survey, figure out what improvements I can make to your building, and you'll save a bunch of money on your electric and your heating bills and your water bills or whatever else it is. And then I'll finance and I'll do all those improvements, and you pay me back, but the amount you're paying me back every month equals your savings.
Wow.
So there's no net extra cash flow out. It's a total win-win.
Mm-hmm.
And this performance contracting is occurring. There are companies coming to Alaska to do more of that. And I know the city of Anchorage has been looking into performance contracting for the city hall building. It just makes a ton of sense.
It's a whole new line of work.
It is.
Yeah.
It's absolutely a whole new line of work.
Well, let's see. When I was, before we moved into our current home, we were renting, and it was 2x4 walls. I think it was 70s or 80s construction. And it was a pretty secluded area, so it wasn't real windy,
mm-hmm.
But when we moved into a four-star building, holy cow, we paid less for a much larger space than we did in that older unit that wasn't nearly as efficient.
No, sometimes the savings can be very, very dramatic. And
yeah.
like I said, payback's 3, 4, 5, 6 years, and that's a great investment any way you look at it.
Okay, don't forget 550-8433 is our number. We're going to go next to Eric on line one. Welcome to the show. Hi, Eric.
Hi. I was calling about trying to develop a process of replacing a wood-burning steam engine with an electric burner and actually power that, have the power from the steam engine turn an alternator to produce electricity, or a steam turbine. And I was really interested in how, if that's possible, to provide energy that is a clean burning source and actually does provide a lot of an immense amount of power, basically reindustrializing the Western world with steam power, steam engines or steam turbines with alternative energy in order to provide power and make up for a lot of energy that isn't currently captured by wind and solar.
Well, Eric, if I'm not quite picturing the device that you're talking about, of course, geothermal is using steam. It's basically just using the Earth's heat to create steam without burning a fossil fuel to boil water to make steam. Steam turbines can be they're an excellent way to generate power, but I'm not aware of the kind of device that you're talking about. Precisely right now. So I really can't give you too much feedback on that particular technology.
Okay, thanks.
All right, well, we'll see what happens in the future. Who knows? You never know it. What right now I'm a little bit curious, only out of ignorance. The Eklutna power dam
hydro
thingy.
Plant, yeah.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that, and how does that generate power at this point?
Okay, that's a good question, because Eklutna is very similar to several other large hydro plants here in Alaska, where you don't have a dam. Instead, what you have is essentially a tunnel, or if you can picture a straw underneath the lake that connects to the bottom of the lake, and then the height differential between the high lake and the low power plant creates what's called the head. And so all of the power comes from that water descending down that tunnel, and then it goes through a regular turbine down there in the powerhouse. And so that's how power is created at Eklutna Lake. That's how power is created at Bradley Lake, for instance. Bradley Lake's the biggest hydro project in the state, down by Homer. It's over 100-megawatt project. So no dam was ever built. They just built a tunnel underneath that connected to the bottom of the lake, and then they use that large head that is generated by that water descending 1,000 feet or so to create the energy. Lake Chocachamna, which I mentioned earlier, would be a similar project. There would not be a dam out there. Instead of basically they would tap into the bottom of this large lake out by Mount Spur, and they're talking about a power tunnel that would be about 12 miles long and 24 feet in diameter, going down 1,000 feet. So if you can imagine that much water, you know, a 12-foot diameter tunnel going down 1,000 feet, there's a heck of a lot of energy there, and that spins the turbines. That would be a 330-megawatt project. To give you some perspective, the peak load on the darkest winter day in the whole rail belt is 850 megawatts.
Wow.
So a 330-megawatt project is a very nice-sized project. It would help, you know, kind of cover some of the aging natural gas generation that we've got going right now.
So how would that come here?
Well, that's a good question, because a lot of renewable energy around Alaska is what we would call stranded. It's very far away from power lines. Chocachamna, Mount Spur, and those places are actually only about 40 miles from the Beluga gas field, though. And Beluga is where the big power plant is that Chugach operates that brings most of the power over to the rail belt and to Anchorage. So the power line starts over there on the other side, on the west side of Cook Inlet. The power line starts at Beluga. So you'd only have to connect that last 40 miles down to Mount Spur and Chocachamna to get both of those projects into our power grid. And if you did that, you could also develop more wind over there. There's a lot of good wind over what they call the Western Forelands over there that will probably never be developed unless the power line gets closer. And on top of that, there's tidal on the west side of Cook Inlet. And when that's commercialized, that could also feed into that same power line. So you get a four for one.
Mm-hmm. We've heard a lot about these in the last, I don't know, decade, 5 years, maybe more. When will we see something? More money from the legislature? More people with interesting ideas?
I think we're going to see something very soon. Like I said, Fire Island, I think, is going to happen. They're opening up the bids on Mount Spur on September 10th.
I want to see those bids.
TDX Power has the FERC exploratory license for Chocachamna, and they're spending a lot of time and effort and money right now looking at that project and figuring out how much it would cost. And like I said, the legislature's spent more money on Susitna. But with those big hydro projects, you know, Chocachamna might take 7 or 8 years to develop. Susitna maybe double that. On the other hand, Fire Island could be built in 18 months because of the nature of that technology. So it could happen much quicker than, let's say, a large hydro project.
Interesting. So now you were saying earlier, I think, that the same people who regulate our current electricity would also regulate this power generation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska would still be regulating the electric generation, regardless of what source it's from.
And would that generation plug into what we have now? If there was something created at Fire Island, is that how it would be distributed?
That's right. And that's what that $25 million from the legislature was for, is to connect
to
an undersea cable over to Fire Island.
Sometimes it takes me a little longer. let's talk a little bit about Denali Green Tags. It's on your website.
Oh, sure.
What are they?
Well, lots of folks have probably heard the term carbon offset. it is a way for people to basically buy renewable energy. Anytime you you hear a company or an individual say, well, I'm buying wind power, and you hear that, you know, lots of companies now are bragging about the wind power that they're buying. They're not actually buying electrons because you can't segregate the electrons. If there's a big wind farm on this rail belt grid, you're never going to be able to segregate which ones were the natural gas electrons and which ones were the wind electrons. And so essentially the way that wind power and other renewable energy is bought and sold is by keeping track of how many megawatt hours are produced and then selling the environmental benefits to that power in the form of green tags. So Denali Green Tags is a program that we developed to try to do a couple things. First of all, have a product that could be offered to the public and to, you know, government agencies and those who have an interest in buying renewable power. But secondly, and probably more importantly, it was a way for us to help the small village utilities in Alaska that were already producing wind power and weren't getting any extra benefit. They weren't selling the environmental attributes. We found our partner, the Bonneville Environmental Foundation, who buys those attributes from Kotzebue Electric and TDX Power and so on. So now Kotzebue gets a little added benefit for producing this clean power. Mm-hmm. So there's several ways that it benefits Alaskans by trying to build up a market for people buying renewable energy.
What about dams? We sort of talked about it a little bit in hydropower. People don't seem to like dams. Mm-hmm. You've talked a little bit about the way Eklutna is set up. Do you think we'll be seeing dams in the future?
Well, the only real dams that are being discussed are the dams that would be part of the Susitna project. And there are two main dams, the Devil's Canyon Dam and the Watana Dam that were proposed. Now, this was 25 years ago when Susitna was being proposed. Those two large dams would hold back a lot of water on the Susitna River and form some reservoirs that would then run power stations. That's a 1,600-megawatt project if you built both of those dams at Susitna. And so, you know, the jury is still out on whether or not the costs outweigh the benefits or vice versa on that project. You know, one of the questions will be, where are we going to use all that power? If we had 1,600 megawatt Susitna project and our peak load's 850 megawatts, where are we going to use it? Of course, in the future, we're going to have things like plug-in hybrids. Mm-hmm. People are going to be plugging their cars in, which is a great way
plug-in
to use.
Snow machines.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, absolutely. I mean, we could start using that extra power for transportation. A lot of people may want to use it for heating. And that would benefit Alaskans. It would be a much different story if we generated that power simply to attract industry. And you know, people are going to have to decide what the costs and benefits of a big project like that would be.
Mm-hmm. And you may not know this, but were environmental impact statements already done for these dams when they were talking about doing it a few years ago?
There was about $160 million spent studying Susitna 25 years ago. And I'm sure part of that was on environmental studies. I'm positive of that. Now, whether or not those studies would have to be redone, I'm not sure. I'm assuming they probably would have to be redone. There's certainly salmon in the Susitna River that people would be concerned about. And there's also – there's going to be quite a bit of flooding of moose habitat that people were concerned about. But I think, again, the jury is still out on the costs and benefits of a big project like that, and that's why the legislature just appropriated $2.5 million to look at it again.
And I know in Washington State, Washington, Idaho, they've had a lot of trouble with the Bonneville dams and the dams that have apparently very negatively impacted salmon.
Well, that's even an understatement. I mean, the salmon runs
gone.
In the Northwest are pretty much decimated, or have
even
like the
ladders.
Yeah, the Columbia work. It's really impacted it adversely. That's for sure. And of course, that I think is the reason why people have this negative image of dams is because they certainly have impacted the salmon in the Northwest. Northwest has cheap power, cheaper than other places, but they don't have any salmon. And Alaskans are pretty darn protective of their salmon.
Yes, we are. Okay, Lise on line 9. I hope that's your name. Welcome to the show.
Hi, are you talking to me?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. I lived in Iceland for a while. And over there, most of power is generated through geothermal energy. We are sitting on top of about 20 gazillion, jillion, illion gigabytes of energy over Crosscook Inlet in the terms of those volcanoes, and I'd like to know why nobody's really done anything to develop it. I mean, yeah, there's some sort of toy stuff like Chena Hot Springs, but the real... Iceland's got so much geothermal energy that a few years ago they were actually thinking about exporting it to Europe through a great big undersea cable.
Mm-hmm.
And, the technology exists. It's wonderful. In Reykjavik, they run hot water from the volcanoes under the streets. They don't even have to plow. So,
whoa.
I'd like to know why we don't use this marvelous resource that we've got here.
Well, I don't know if you heard me speaking about it earlier, Lise, but Mount Spur is being leased now by the state. The area out there is being leased, and the bids will be opened up September 10th. And so we're getting very, very close, finally, because I agree, it is a great resource. We're getting very close now to seeing what interest there is in developing that area over Mount Spur. And you're right about Iceland. We visited there a few years ago. They get 99% of their heat from geothermal. They get about 20% of their electricity from geothermal. The rest is hydro. And they use that water multiple times. Like Lee said, they use it for generating electricity. Then they use it to heat. Then they use it to heat swimming pools all around Reykjavik.
Wow.
And then they run it through the streets and sidewalks. They use it for greenhouses and all kinds of different stuff.
Yeah, the most vegetables that are grown there are grown over a geothermal spring in an area called Kretagerti, which means hot spring gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's like something like several thousand acres under glass.
Yeah, it is amazing, and there's no reason why we shouldn't be developing it. And as you well know, the Blue Lagoon, which is basically where they take all the excess hot water from one of the power plants, is the biggest tourist attraction in Iceland, and it generates way more income for that power plant than they get from selling heat and electricity. So,
moreover, the product of the Blue Lagoon, which is microcrystalline minerals, has been shown to be a cure for psoriasis, and the National Health Service built a hospital on the edge of it.
Yeah, they sell that cream with that stuff in there for like $40 a tube. It's
yeah, it's incredible.
It would be great if Mount Spur were developed.
We've got that potential. It's a wonderful source. It breaks my heart to see it just sitting there not used.
Well, cross your fingers. Yeah, cross your fingers and hope that we've got some good developers coming in to look at it.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for your call. We're always behind. It's just inevitable. We're one of the youngest states, and it's just taking us forever to build up infrastructure, and it's so expensive. It's such a huge state, but hopefully we'll be getting there.
Well, Iceland's a great example that we talk about a lot because they had vision. They had political will.
Okay, go out there and build, Chris. Build. Okay, thanks for joining us today, and next week looks like clean elections might be coming up, so I'm your host, Nellie Moore. I'll see you next week on Community Forum. Thank you, Chris, for being here.
Thanks, Nellie.
Forum is a production of KSKA's News and Public Affairs Department. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write to us, KSKA 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska 99508, or email us at communityforum@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/communityforum. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.